Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op.
Hello to our listeners in Preston, St Albans and around the world via the internet. Our guests this week are Wendy Isaacs and Hayley Wakeman from the Bristol Society for Paranormal Research and Investigation. We also have a feature from Anthea Page about Robert Burns' last letter.
Tony Gosling is here talking to Eurosceptic Idrid Francis. Plus, we have Alec Milne reading the third part of Selected Letters by Robert Louis Stevenson.
Trevor Carter is here to read us some of his poetry. And Jeff Sparks is here with his What's On Guide and Song of the Week.
I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce Wendy Isaacs and Hayley Wakeman from the Bristol Society for Paranormal Research and Investigation. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
That's quite a wordy title for a society. So can you describe kind of what does your society do?
Well, we investigate alleged ghost sightings and events that happen in people's homes and
pubs
anywhere, really, that they think they've got, you know,
activity of any kind.
So as a society, you actively investigate these kind of...
Yes, we do, yeah.
These events. OK, I mean, how long has the society been going?
It was founded back in October 2003 by three former members of Bristol Ghost Club. And they wanted to come up with a group that don't just do the science side of it or just the spiritual side. So it's a mixture between the two. So we like to get both sides of the coin addressed.
So it's not just the thrill seekers then?
No, we don't.
Not.
No.
I think a lot of people do have that idea that you come along and we're just screaming and shouting and swearing galore. And, you know, it's not like on the telly. I think it's been sort of glorified a lot and it's not like that.
What do you think of those kind of shows? Do you think that they're good because they promote the paranormal?
Entertaining. That's all they are. They're not really factual. Really. I think they sort of open it up to a lot of people to sort of look into it and join a group like ours, but they do leave disappointed that it can be long, boring, cold. I mean, some of these buildings are derelict, no heating, no roof, and you're there for hours. You know, Woodchester Mansion we went to recently, and it's freezing. Sometimes you can have nothing happen whatsoever, but you don't think, well, it's not haunted then. You have to sort of repeat visits. That's the only thing you can do. People go, you know, if they're not really wise into these things and they go, oh, I go somewhere, didn't see anything, it's not haunted, that's it, wouldn't go back. But really, to be successful, you need to do repeat visits, especially if there's a lot of information about it or eyewitness accounts on it, then you can't really judge on one evening, really.
So there's a real commitment then to the group?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You do get some people join the group, and because it's not like almost haunted, they don't come back again. Because it is glorified on there, and it is for entertainment, and it is called an entertainment show.
It happens quickly
show.
As well, yeah.
Yeah. So, but for all the things that don't happen, every now and again we'll have something that's like, wow, how did that happen? You know, you look at all the plausible explanations and sometimes there isn't one.
So give us an example of that.
Woodchester Mansion, not much happened this time, but one of my first visits there, a group of us was in the cellar area of the building and we had the locked off camera set up pointing towards the group we were in, pretty much sort of like quite a small room, and the camera switched off but it was plugged into the mains and we were like a little bit confused why that happened. And with that we had stones thrown at us, one nearly hit me, somebody else nearly got hit as well. It was kind of, it starts in the stereo, so we've got to step back a little bit and see, you know, if there was a logical explanation. Did somebody throw it through the window? Because it was in the cellar area, so there was a window leading into it, so it could have been somebody went outside. It was snowing. So our manager of the group at the time went outside to see if anybody could have threw something through the window, and the snow was perfect. There was no footsteps, no footprints at all in the snow. So we pretty much ruled that out. There was no loose stones from the ceiling that could have caused it. But it pretty much happened over the space of about 10 minutes, about half a dozen times, perhaps a few more times than that. And we know nobody in the group could have done it because you've got to have an element of trust with your members. That's why we have meetings once a month. So you build up a trust.
That must have been quite scary then.
It was. We were actually in the Evening Post. We had a reporter with us at the time, but she was freezing, so she decided to sit out of that vigil. She was upstairs warming herself by the fire, which was a shame, really, because if she was down there, I think it would have blown her away. But yeah, it was. For us, it was there. It was quite well. It was unexpected. So no logical explanation. I kind of put it in a box that we can't explain that one.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't necessarily say it's paranormal, because most things can be explained. It's the 1% that we're looking for that can't be explained in any way.
So it didn't fit in with the kind of a history of the place, or in kind of, you know, looking, I presume your investigations looked at that kind of evidence.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't kind of find another explanation or yeah. where, even if it was paranormal, where it would have come from.
No. We go down every route. I mean, I say, people, as soon as you say you belong to a paranormal group, they do think, oh, you know, you're into ghosts then, are you? Find ghosts, you're friends with Casper, and everything you can imagine they've said. And you just think, well, no, because we are more a fact group. We're not a scientific group, and there are out there, they use every gadget equipment you can think of. Some are totally useless because they see it on programs that you have to have these meters, readings, infrared, everything, and a lot of it is useless. It doesn't tell you anything apart from you can see in the dark, or, you know, thing numbers fluctuate. It doesn't really tell you, because there's no rule book on how to find a ghost, so everyone's trying to find their way and come to some sort of unanimous idea of what, you know, what maybe prove something and maybe not, but there's no guidebook. But we are definitely in the road of trying to find an explanation. We're not like, oh my god, there's a shadow, it's a ghost, it's a tree outside. You know, most of the time it can really be rationalized. Yeah, you know?
So there was kind of no rational explation for this particular event.
And some quite a lot like that, aren't there?
Yeah,
you know, that you can't, but, and we're sort of mystified. You know, mediums in the group, they can, we do have mediums go along with us, but, you know, for a science only group, they'd push that aside.
The thing is, our medium is a psychologist as well, so he doesn't just do, he's a realist,
yeah,
and he doesn't just go in there and go, oh, I'm picking up on the spirit of a woman. He'll do the psychology side of it as well. He'll do it from the, you know, the skeptic, open-minded skeptic side, which is, it's quite refreshing, really, because a lot of mediums are a little bit hairy-fairy, let's face it.
They are, aren't they?
We've met a few weirdos in our time, yeah. I can tell you.
Real dramatic and, oh, I'm picking up on. And it's a load of rubbish most of the time.
So, mentioning that you had several people kind of part of the society, all different types. So, what you used the word realist skeptic, was that?
Yeah.
Would you describe kind of the majority of your kind of society as being in that vein, or?
Yeah, I mean, we've got believers, but they're open-minded believers. You know, they know that things can be rationalised. We haven't got anyone, we haven't, like, spiritualist group, they would believe a lot that you would be sat there going, oh my god, can't they see that this is what it is? But they're so tunnel vision, they want to believe stuff that they can't prove to us. So perhaps they're right and we're wrong, perhaps there is something, but until they can believe it and prove it to us, obviously you've got to take it with a pinch of salt. Same as like, you know, being hypnotized, for example. You can watch it and you can think, that looks good, but I think it's set up, or I think that's wrong, or I think that's rubbish, or whatever. If you had it happen to you, you'd believe it. And it's exactly the same. If you went to an investigation and something happened you could not explain, you would be blown away. But to try and explain that to people, like, oh, yeah, you know, because so much can be faked. So it's a bit frustrating for us, because sometimes you see, you know, people are like, whatever you're saying to them, they don't believe. And you can tell that, and you're thinking, I might as well just shut up then, because you're not going to believe it unless you come along. But I find it amazing that if you say, why don't you come along to one of these? Oh, no. Well, why not? Don't
too
believe in that. They are too scared. And they won't stay in like a haunted bed and breakfast, like you said. There's no way they do it. And yeah. I think, well, I don't understand that.
Well, when I joined the society, I actually was a believer out and out, because things used to happen in my house that I grew up in that could not be explained in my eyes. Really strange things, not just by me, but other members of the house experienced it as well. So when I joined, I was a believer, and over those years I've got more and more skeptical, and I like to think now I'm open-minded, so I go in, it's like a blank canvas, rather than go in with preconceived ideas.
So the society is kind of welcoming to kind of to all, and
yes.
you kind of work
yeah.
through your kind
yeah
of,
you do yeah
yeah
but
how
really
you
you know
it?
We would say to people who did want to join or whatever, you're more than welcome, but please take it quite seriously, because you do have a lot of people who think it's a bit of a party. Yeah, and then you can go to Warwick Castle or London Dungeon and have a laugh, you know, and be scared, you know, or Passage of Terror, Blackpool, brilliant, but it's not real.
So how can people get involved if they're interested?
Well, we've got a website. We're actually, it's under construction at the moment because we're being given a bit of a facelift at the moment. But we're on Facebook as well. If you put BSPRI in, because obviously the Bristol Society is a little bit long, the whole title. So if you put BSPRI on Facebook, and you'll find us there. It's also www.bspri.org.uk. So there's that one.
Brilliant. And I believe you've got an event, Wendy.
Yes, we have. Myself and Bruce, that used to be a member of Phantom Fest, came up with the idea of doing an event once a year, a huge event, at a castle that is alleged to be haunted. And in June 17th to the 19th, we've got Ghost Fest Southwest that we founded this year. And we're doing it to raise money for charity, and that's what the emphasis is on rather than the ghosts. So we've got people like Kieran O'Keefe. Who else have we got? Help
Richard
me out.
Jones, Richard James, James Stevens, yeah. Richard Skeets.
So we've got talks going on, two nights investigations. That's all on Facebook as well. So just put in Ghost Fest Southwest and you'll find it.
Amazing. Thank you very much, Wendy
Thank
and Hayley.
You very much.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Ah, time for a song now, and this is Charlie Is My Darling by Eddie Reader.
Fog, horn, I said leg, horn.
Was on a Monday morning, right early in the year, that Charlie came to our town, the young chevalier. Oh, Charlie is my darling, my darling, my darling. Charlie is my darling, the young chevalier. As he was walking down the street, the city far to view, oh, there he spied a bonny lass, the windy peeking through. Charlie is my darling, my darling, my darling. Charlie is my darling, the young chevalier. He jumped up the stairs and tittled at the pen, and who's ready but herself to let the laddie in? Oh, Charlie is my darling, my darling, my darling. Charlie is my darling, the young chevalier. He set his Jenny on his knee, all in his Highland dress, for brawly willy kept the way to please a Highland lass. So, Charlie is my darling, my darling, my darling. Charlie is my darling, the young chevalier. Yeah. It's up yon heathery mountain and down yon scroggy glen, we dare ni gang a milking for Charlie and all of his men. Charlie is my darling, my darling, my darling. Charlie is my darling, the young chevalier. Oh, Charlie, Charlie, the young chevalier. Charlie is my darling, my darling, my darling. Charlie is my darling, the young chevalier. Charlie is my darling.
Yeah. Well, that was Eddie Reader. Anthea Page recently visited the National Archive in Edinburgh and spoke to a gentleman named David Brown about Robert Burns' last letter.
Well, I'm at the National Archive of Scotland in Charlotte Square. I'm here now with David Brown. Can you tell us your role at the National Archive Museum?
Yes, I'm head of collections development branch at the National Archives of Scotland, and part of our work is to catalogue the records of private and other families held by the National Archives.
And I'm actually looking at a letter.
On 14 July 1796, Robert Burns visited his workplace, the Excise Office in Dumfries. The touching farewell that the dying poet took of colleagues is recorded in a newly discovered letter in the National Archives of Scotland. This remarkable document reveals how, despite being reduced and shattered in his final illness, Burns's lively spirit remained. During his last years, he suffered from what was probably rheumatic heart disease, complicated by bacterial endocarditis. At last, he was unable to work, and on medical advice, attempted a cure of sea bathing at Brow on Solway, near Dumfries. He went there on 3rd July 1796 and reassured his wife, Jean Armour, who was expecting her ninth child, that he was getting some benefit from bathing. He was still attempting to write songs, but his appetite had gone and he could only take porridge and milk. He told friends he felt himself to be dying. A lawyer's letter demanding payment of a debt for his volunteer's uniform caused him further distress. To ease his situation, he begged money from friends and family. The letter, dated 24th July 1796, was written by his superior officer, John Mitchell, collector of excise at Dumfries, to Robert Graham of Fintry, commissioner of excise, who had befriended Burns and found him a job in the service. It belongs to Graham's personal papers, now in the National Archives of Scotland. Dear Sir, this is Mitchell writing to Robert Graham of Fintry. Upon my return home today, having been in the country all last week attending revenue courts, I found poor Burns was no more. He died on Thursday. The memory of so uncommonly rare a character is to be regarded at his funeral tomorrow. Having cavalry and infantry here, they are to attend, in mourning, and our volunteers to fire over his grave. He, with difficulty, came to the excise office on the 14th, the collection day, and got his salary. From his weak state, he was urged not to come, but he would, saying, "Once more he hoped to be able to go and draw it from me at the proper place, and I shall not soon forget his appearance and manner." Reduced and shattered as he was, in the extreme, his wit and humour remained. As one instance, some of the officers, as he thought, looking at his hat, says he, "I believe there is no stamp in the crown," but pleads exemption as being in quest of a crown of glory. "To me," he remarked, "I'm only 36, 10 of which only I have been in the world, and in that time all I shall say, my good sir, I have not been idle. By your favours of the 20th, I am much obliged for your attention regarding Mr. Penn succeeding to the vacancy. He has long given proof of being a capable officer and has long had a footwalk, hence a preferable claim to any in this collection. I shall, by tomorrow's post, officially acquaint the Honourable Board and propose the arrangement as, in my opinion, most conducive to the interest of the revenue. Respectfully, I am, your obedient, humble servant, John Mitchell." Dumfries, Sunday, 24th July, 1796.
So I'm very pleased to meet the descendants of John Mitchell. Can you tell us a bit more about that? What's your name, please?
I'm Lindsay. This is my cousin Sally. We didn't find the letter, but we read in the newspaper that it had been found, and we were terribly excited because we've been researching our ancestry and we've always had a particular interest in John Mitchell. And we have got quite a lot of information about him, but the idea that there are new letters or there are letters around which we didn't know about is very exciting to us. It might give us even more information about our great times eight grandfather. Obviously, I think if they've come out of exchanges about excise, they're going to be much more business-like letters. I must admit, as a family researcher, we're terribly interested to know about what his wife was doing at the time and what his address was in Dumfries, and none of that is coming through. But if there's this letter, there might be others, and we'll be very interested to see if we can find more and find more out about our man.
It's quite hard sometimes to collect letters from that long ago.
It is. Luckily enough, we have some family papers, none specifically from John Mitchell, but quite a few from his daughters, which have told us a little bit about him and about the rest of the family and where they all dispersed to. he was a remarkable man in that in the space of his life, his wife had, I think, 17 children, included in which were a set of triplets and a set of twins. So I think by the time he was 12 years married, he had 14 children, which was pretty good going. So the family is very interesting, and working out where they went across the world is very interesting as well. But the one from whom we are descended came to Musselburgh, which is where we come from as well. So we didn't really travel very far from where our ancestors came from.
We bought this collection some while ago, and we were well aware that the papers of the Graham family of Fintry might well have held material about Robert Burns, and we are putting together a project with Edinburgh University to see whether or not we could raise funding to get a detailed catalogue produced. And it was part of the preparation for that that I stumbled across this letter by John Mitchell, who was Robert Burns's boss at the excise office in Dumfries. It's interesting for a number of reasons. From a narrow one, it solves a minor mystery in the public records. We have known for many, many years that Robert Burns made his last signature in his salary book to collect his salary on the 14th of July, 1796. We've never understood how he was able to do this, because all the other historical records we have show that Burns was 10 miles away at a place called Brough, down on the Solway Firth. This letter tells us for the first time that he made a penultimate visit to Dumfries on the 14th. It must have been desperately difficult for him. The letter is very clear that he was in some dire straits. He was extreme shattered, I think is the description of him. He made it, presumably in a carriage, the 10 miles to sign for his salary and collect it. And while he was there, we have this extraordinary image of him both joking with his colleagues in the excise. His fellow office workers seem to have taken exception to his hat and appear to have implied that he had not paid the stamp tax which he was supposed to pay on hats, or at least hats of a certain value. What we also see is that he turns to John Mitchell and gives what is quite clearly a knowing valedictory on his own life, saying that he's been alive 36 years and, as he puts it, 10 years in the world. We understand means, of course, that it's 10 years since he published the Kilmarnock edition of his poems. That is 10 years since he first became noticed by the general public. He then concludes by saying to John Mitchell, "I think I have not been idle," which is his valedictory, essentially, on his life and career. He would have known, I think, at that stage, or he would have been reasonably certain that he was fatally ill. He returns to Dumfries on the 10th of July and dies 3 days later on the 21st. This letter is written on the 24th of July. So John Mitchell is, as it were, right after the fact. It's very, very near. In effect, this is the first, I suspect, official notification that the excise office in Edinburgh would have had that one of their employees, Robert Burns, was dead.
In that letter, there's a famous quotation of Burns, isn't there? "I have not been idle."
Well, it's not famous, but I think it deserves to be famous now. It is very much his valedictory. He must have known that he was dying, and it's a pretty good summation. He's had 10 years of producing his own poems, of collecting the poems and songs of others, and I think the 200 years since that have shown his idleness has not been noted. He has not been idle.
Have you got many original documents by Burns here?
We have very few original documents by Burns himself. He was a civil servant, a public servant, working for the excise from 1789 until his death in 1796. And so his signature occurs regularly in excise records. We don't have any great body of letters or papers by him. That's just one of these things. Quite quickly after his death, Burns' correspondence and letters became collector's items. We know that his library was dispersed very quickly, and many of his letters and private papers were taken away quickly. This is why you find Burns' letters now scattered in libraries and archives and museums all over the world, and in private collections as well.
Well, there we go. That was about Robert Burns for fairly obvious reasons, I hope, I trust. That was thank you very much to David Brown, that was he, of the National Archive in Edinburgh, and thank you to Anthea Page also.
And now here is Alec Milne to read the third part of the Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest Mayhew, and the music is Duff, performed by Concerto Caledonia.
The Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. October 1873 to April 1874. Stevenson came to London on 25th October to take the preliminary law examination in order to enter one of the Inns of Court. Colvin and Mrs. Sitwell were worried by his ill health, and in particular by the nervous exhaustion largely brought about by the bitter disagreement with his father. At their prompting, he saw Dr. Andrew Clark, who forbade him to take the examination or to return home. The next day, in a written opinion, Clark recommended that to hasten his recovery, he should go to the south of France. As soon as he heard the news, RLS's parents hurried down to London to consult Clark themselves. They saw him on the 4th of November. He was quite firm that RLS should go to the south of France, and equally firm that his mother should not accompany him. RLS wrote triumphantly to Mrs. Sitwell, "Clark is a trump. He said I must go abroad, and that I was better alone. Mothers," he said, "just put fancies into people's heads and make them fancy themselves worse than they are." My mother, with some justice, denied this soft impeachment. However, they are evidently bent on my return in 6 weeks at longest. I hope they may find resignation, for methinks I shall manage to disappoint them. By 6 November, RLS was in Paris and travelling south via Sens, Lyon, Orange and Avignon. He reached Mentone on the 12th. To Francis Sitwell, 10th November 1873, Avignon. I have just read your letter up to the top of the hill, besides the church and castle. The whole air was filled with sunset and sound of bells. And I wish I could give you the least notion of the southernness and provençality of all that I saw. I thought, as I had often thought before, though I do not know that I ever put it into words, that I should like to read nothing but letters from you. So you had it out with my father. I thought you must have played some strong card. He seemed to think so much more of you than he had done before he left in the cab. He drove with me to the station. He was continually bringing the conversation round you. I cannot write while I am travelling. C'est en défaut. But so it is. I must have a certain feeling of being at home, and my head must have time to settle. The new images oppress me, and I have a fever of restlessness on me. You must not be disappointed at such shabby letters, and besides, remember my poor head and the fanciful crawling on my spine. Your letter has done me so much good. It was just like getting a long breath again. So it is all true. I am so glad the lectures are going on all right. I don't know the day of the month, nor, what is my climax of happiness, the day of the week. I knew the day of the month yesterday, or this morning. The other has gone a good while. It is wonderful how seldom I consciously think of you, only whenever I try to express anything to myself, it is a letter to you, and whenever I make to myself any scheme for the future, it is always subject to you, and in fact, though it really boils over, my mind is in a constant quiet simmer of you and all your belongings. I am back again in the stage of thinking there is nothing the matter with me, which is a good sign, but I am wretchedly nervous. Anything like rudeness I am simply babyish afraid of, and noises, and especially the sounds of certain voices, are the devil to me. A blind poet who I found selling his immortal works on the streets of Sens captivated me with the remarkable equable strength and sweetness of his voice, and I listened a long while and bought some of his poems. And now this voice, after I had it thus got thoroughly into my head, proved false metal and a really bad, horrible voice at bottom. It haunted me for some time, but I think I am done with it now. I hope you don't dislike reading bad style like this as much as I do writing it. It hurts me when neither words nor clauses falls into place, much as it would hurt you to sing when you had a bad cold and your voice deceived you and missed every other note. I do feel so inclined to break the pen and write no more. And here, apropos, begins my back. Mother, 15th November 1873, Menton. I just jot down a word or two as the beginning of my note. I shall try to finish for you tomorrow. I have received from Colvin a card to a certain Andrewses who live in the Villa d'Adamore and so are quite close. The Dewars also are quite close, and I met Mrs. Dewar and the boy today and was asked very kindly to call. There's a very nice man here called Dowson, with a pretty wife and son. He talks literature heavily with me. I'm afraid, although much inclined, I shall have to look out for society a little, for I cannot read much, and so lack for occupation. Little Barbara is here. Dowson told him I was here, and he recollected me, and said he would look me up. I have not yet found courage enough to go into Nice, but must do so shortly, I suppose, and unbosom myself to Bennett. Many thanks for your letters and the pamphlets. Tell my father I was very thick with some commercial travellers at Orange, and that one of them, comparing France with England, said I should never get so much cheated in France. I demurred. Well, he said, just look at this. You never get cheated by a cabman in France, or overcharged at a railway station, as you do in England. Perhaps after this remarkable inversion of his favourite statement, he will begin to prepare to commence to believe that no man can judge a foreign nation. Next day, 16th November. Today it was cloudy a little and cold, so I have to light my fire and resign myself to the house for the afternoon. I forgot to thank you for the Hill Burton yesterday. Bien oblige. There are hereby, on the gate pillar of a villa, two inimitable plaster lions, which are evidently the work of a humorist of the first water. One of them lies with his jowl on his spread paws, his eyes sleepily half opened, a greasy smile on his wide mouth, and bathed, so to speak, all in an atmosphere of brutal repletion. The other, stretching his neck up at it easily, and showing his big teeth in an act of dolorous snarling, has plainly carried his dinner just a degree further, and now, undergoing the pains and penalties of speedy indigestion. I am sure my father would be delighted with this pair of jolly gormandizers. Dowson has lent me Clough, which I like a good deal, and I am reading Miss Edgeworth's Popular Tales for the Young with thorough gusto. They are often clumsy and transparent, but is a fine milk diet for the mind. A Catholic, Mrs. Devonish Walsh, lady, who goes in for being a swell, and whose talk run much on princess and barons, lords and ladies, and people of high degree, has told me of a book which will interest you. Mrs. Gerald's Niece, by Lady G. Fullerton. It is about Roman Catholic controversies, but the scene is laid in Menton, and I hear that the descriptions are really charming. You better see for yourself. Mrs. Walsh is a good-natured person. She sits at the head of the table, then Mr. and Mrs. Dowson, and at lunch their little son, then at dinner only a certain Mr. and Miss Moon, who do not much interest me. He, poor fellow, is evidently very ill, however, quite the feeble one of the party. All the rest of us, indeed, look much happily robust. Dowson and I expressed mutual incredulity in each other's bad health, and Mrs. Walsh is a jolly, fat, healthy, active, bustling lady of 45, maybe, who looks as if she had never been ill in her life. Happy thoughts, Mrs. Devilish Walsh. A person with a cold in his head, you see.
Thank you very much to Alec Milne there. He was reading the third part of the selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Thanks very much, Alec.
Time for another song now. It's John Anderson, My Joe, by Eddie Reader. It's worth pointing out that Eddie Reader is on a tour. It starts on the 4th of April in Cardiff. If you want to find out more about that, visit www.eddiereader.co.uk.
John Anderson, my Joe, John Anderson, my Joe, when we were first acquaint, your locks were like the raven, your bonny brow was brent, but now your brow is belled, John, and your locks are like the snow. But blessings on your frosty pow, John Anderson, my Joe. John Anderson, my Joe, we'd climb the hill together, and money's a county deed, John, we had we in another. Now we mun totter down, John, and hand we'll go to sleep together at the fet. John Anderson, my Joe, John Anderson, my Joe.
Idris Francis is a Eurosceptic. He is a former Conservative who is now in the biggest party in the British European elections, the UK Independence Party. And he's also a member of the Campaign for an Independent Britain and is convinced that MEPs have no power and that the EU is a vast bureaucratic institution based on fraud.
But as you know, the accounts have never been approved by the auditors ever since the auditing system was set up at 16 years. And any organisation, commercial organisation, that behaved like that would long ago have been closed down. But the European Union, of course, hasn't. It just carries on. So how is it that an organisation can be so corrupt with such huge amounts of money? How can it be that, as I've been told by MEPs, that there are large numbers of people working in Brussels for the Commission well over retirement age because they dare not leave for fear of what their successors will find? How can it be that right across the board they fiddle their expenses? They sign on in the morning and get on the plane for home, like Kinnock's wife did, and lots of others, and so on and so on. How can it be all so corrupt? Surely it is the case that it is like that because it was designed to be like that from the very beginning, to ensure that there would be enormous amounts of money, unlimited amounts of money, available to these people in slush funds to do what the hell they liked, and to ensure a ready supply of MEPs who, with their high salaries and fraudulent expenses, wouldn't want to rock the boat, and to ensure the people who worked for them for the same reasons will be happy to keep this corrupt ship afloat. It must have been designed like that from the very beginning, wasn't it? There's never any question about it. The reason it is corrupt is that they want it to be corrupt. And the reason it hasn't been stopped is that they don't want to stop it. That is the nature of the organization that runs your life and mine now. And I don't know about you, but I've had enough of it. I've known about it for 18 years. And as I said to Chris Hoon, when he snootily said to a meeting of people, "Oh, the only reason you don't like the EU is that you don't know anything about it," I said, "Mr. Hoon, I've studied the EU since 1992, and I've spent thousands of hours doing it. I can assure you, I know more about it than you do. And what's more, the more I know, the worse it gets." And that really is true. Every day brings new horrors of incompetence and determination to squeeze this country and destroy it for the advantage of the greater Germany and the greater France. When that French Prime Minister was here a few days ago trying to make out how Anglophile he was, he also said that it is absolutely essential to have greater integration to save the euro, that we can't escape, that we have no alternative. Well, I got news for whatever his name is. He can go and take a running jump, because I haven't lived in this country for 71 years to be told what to do by Frenchmen I have never elected and never would have the chance to elect, nor have I lived in this country to see it taken over by thieves and crooks and liars and cheats and charlatans, and that's what they are, every man jack of them.
Actually, Britain is still run from Westminster, and there's a certain amount of paranoia of people saying it's run from Brussels.
I asked the head of the Health and Safety Agency at a fringe meeting, "What proportion of the laws that you enforce come from Brussels?" And he thought for a while, and he said about 80%. The vast majority of the laws that EU introduces, which is about, opinions differ, 60, 70, 80%, go through Parliament on the nod. And Parliament does not have the power to change one single dot or comma in any of it. They can stand on their hind legs and argue about it. They can talk about it and discuss it, but change it they cannot do. It is not allowed. About 18 months ago, the then new head of the European Parliament, Gert Pottinger, called into his office Daniel Hannan, MEP, and Roger Helmer, MEP, both Conservatives, and both of whom I know quite well, and fined them £1,000 each for showing dissent in the European Parliament, saying dissent is not allowed. Well, as it happened, 2 weeks later, he was in London on his circular tour, having been appointed head, and he was speaking at the LSE, although it was a public meeting, and I went along, as did Mark Glendinning of the Democracy Movement. From the third row, I heard him talk about meeting the Queen and meeting Gordon Brown and David Cameron and what a wonderful country this was and democracy and all of that. And I interrupted him, to the astonishment of an audience that was largely Europhile, and said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Pottinger, you don't understand democracy. Only last week you called into your office two MEPs and fined them £1,000 each, saying that dissent is not allowed." He tried to deny it, and I then named the MEPs and said, "I know them both." I said, "Your view of democracy is rather strange. In this country, we pay Her Majesty's loyal opposition precisely to show dissent. That is what they do. They stand on their hind legs and dissent. But in your version of the world, dissent is not allowed. Only the people who are in charge have any right to say anything or to formulate policy, and we are not allowed to disagree. If you call that democracy, when it's a very funny democracy, and I don't agree with it." This, incidentally, is not verbatim, but is substantially what I said, and was later reported in private eye. "Do you want to live in a country where politicians are told that they may not disagree? Doesn't that give you a chill feeling in your stomach? Doesn't it remind you of 1984?
What can we do about all this?
Get out. Even the people who, for the last 10 years, have effectively said this, "Oh, no, no, we mustn't talk about leaving." Oh, Tebbit is another one, of course. "We mustn't talk about leaving. People aren't ready for that yet. We must just talk about fixing it. Even they now are saying publicly and in print and in the Express recently, there is no possibility whatever of ever fixing the European Union from within.
Former businessman Idris Francis there speaking to Dialect's Tony Gosling, and the Campaign for an Independent Britain can be found at www.eurofac, that's EuroFaq.freeuk, that's all one word, .com. So that's www.eurofac.freeuk.com.
The Bard of Windmill Hill is here, Mr. Trevor Carter. Hello.
Hello, John.
How have you been?
I was fine until lunchtime. I started to feel wonky this afternoon.
You're feeling wonky? Well, wonky, I think this isn't going to affect your poetry. But
Who am I to judge, you know?
Okay, well, thrill us with your poetry and then I'll be able to give you a thumbs up or down.
This is a rather somber piece, this first one.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. It's called Secret Burden. Remembering his past, he wept, although the wars were long ago, for all the secrets that he kept. He tried too hard to be adept and not to let them know. Remembering his past, he wept. Long suppressed, yet back they crept and would not let him go, those dark secrets that he kept. He'd kept them in the dark, except sometimes his thoughts would show. Then, remembering his past, he wept. For all that he could not accept, he feared the hammer blow, for all the secrets that he kept. For all the feelings that have slept and burdened him with woe, remembering his past, he wept for all the secrets that he kept.
I very much like that. Your wonkiness has not affected your poetry. You'll be pleased to hear. Do you have anything else for us?
Yes.
Or must you? Are you having it?
Yes, a very different kind of thing.
Okay. Is this more upbeat?
You could say it's more jaunty.
Ooh.
Yes, it's a bit of a rant, I suppose you could really.
Rant away.
Rant away. Here we go. Tescopoli. Demonic force. The cathedrals of consumption dominate the modern city, and they thrive on greed's presumption. They don't waste time on pity for the personal, the peculiar, the precious or the small. They're not content to dominate. They want to have it all. They are designed to propagate, to strangle wayward shops. They do not halt or hesitate. Expansion never stops. The bog-off buys, the discount lies, the choice of endless choice. The vacant eyes, the stifled cries of those who have no voice, are features of the modern trend to more Tescopoli. That tells us that real choice must end. That's how the world must be. There'll be no choice for those who want to lead untescoed lives, who'd rather shop from different shops where diversity survives. Who would rather not feed the beasts who stalk the once fair land, who do not seek to fuel the feasts of ever more demand. There comes a time when tides should turn, and such a time's at hand. There comes a time the world should learn that Tesco should be damned. So pin your colours to the mast, don't dangle the white flag, don't let our future disappear inside a Tesco bag. Don't be deterred by what you've heard, the fight can still be won. Decision cannot be deferred. The battle has begun. Let's stand up to Tescopoli. Let's say enough's enough. We don't want more monopoly. We want more local stuff. Let's think about this properly. Let us reject their plan. Let us turn back Tescopoli. Let's do it while we can.
Interesting. Yeah, it's always worthy of note that the rather more English and sedate Sainsbury's, whenever they open a store, this is always unnoticed, without fanfare. And I wonder what lessons capitalism could draw from that, possibly, or Tesco's executives. Who knows? Trevor Carter, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Well, here he is in his camouflage trousers, so that presumably he can leap into military combat at a moment's notice. Our local lad, Jeff Sparks. Please, tell us what is going on this week.
Thank you, John. This is a What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 4th of February, Murder Dolls will be performing with support from Black Veil Brides and also The Defiled at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 6 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. Also on 4th of February, the Madness tribute band Nuttiness will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance and £7 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Billy Connolly. This is from the album Comedy and Songs, which was released in 2008, and is a track titled Govan Dunn Blues.
When I first came onto the folk scene in Glasgow, most people were singing Aberdonian bothy ballad things. And all the wee Glasgow guys were practising their Aberdeen accents, you know. Ola hoi, ho, and ola, hello, wally, ho. And going on, so they all sang like that. And it was bloody murder. Really. And even I was practising. Oh no. And then one day, a blues caravan came to Glasgow with Big Mama Thornton and all sorts of people. And everybody went, oh yeah, oh yeah. And ran out and bought Czechoslovakian guitars and ran home to practice Mississippi accents, you see. And the result was quite astounding. And I have an example here. This is called Govan Dunny Blues. Oh, yeah! That's Gaelic for oh, yes. Last I've got a bun. Put on your stainless steel wellies, baby, with a chanty on your head. Put on your stainless steel wellies, baby, with a chanty on your head. When you walk down Sucky Hall Street, oh Jesus Christ, you're gonna knock them dead. You know I dyed my nipples black. Should have seen the mess around summit. And when I crawled into your bedroom, you know you were snoring on your back. Oh yeah, och. Your bowler hat with sleeves. I really didn't mind your Fair Isle balaclava or your bowler hat with sleeves. Oh, but when you turned up in stilts, baby, well, that was just too much for me. Put on your barbed wire knickers, honey, with your cement front to back. Nickers, baby, with your cement front to back. I want to kiss St. Michael. Oh, when you come back to Govan, ah, you're gonna cop your wife.
That was Billy Connolly with Govan Dunn Blues from the album Comedy and Songs. For more information, you can check out www.billyconnolly.com. Moving into Saturday, 5th of February, The Hold Steady will be performing with support at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15.50 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 6th of February, James Morton and Friends will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Well, that's the end of this week's Dialect Radio Show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based in the city centre in Bristol. Our features this week were brought to you by Dialect Radio reporter Anthea Page, Tony Gosling and Alec Milne. Studio guests were Wendy Isaacs and Hayley Wakeman, and poetry was by Trevor Carter. The What's On Guide was, of course, presented by Jeff Sparks.
The studio was engineered very proficiently, as ever, by Michael Noyes. This week's show was produced by Jeff Sparks. It's goodbye from all here at Dialect, and it's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman.
And myself, Michaela Dennis.
Presenters of this week's show, and until next week, goodbye.
They're tearing